Okay. Right, I'm going to get started. I think some more will join. For those of you that know me, hello, good morning again. For those of you that don't, I'm Peter. I'm partner with NPM Legal. We're a specialist employment and business immigration practice. We're based in the south of England, but we work with clients all over the world that have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. Joined this morning for this Employment 101 session by my colleague Sarah. Jazz hands again. Morning, Sarah.
Hello.
This is the second in our latest webinar series, Employment 101. And with this particular series, they're bite-sized sessions, so 20, 25 minutes, where we're basically going through the employee life cycle with a different topic each week. And we're just having a short refresher of the basics, or it might be something like today, which is super topical. And we just really want to give you the benefit of our thoughts and opinions and listen to some ideas that you might have in the comments as well, with some practical ideas and tips at the end as well. So on that point, we are recording the session. We're going to host it on our website afterwards. So feel free to share it if you think anyone who's not here today would like to see it. And if you've got any questions, we'll try our best to answer them in the session. If we can't, we can always email you afterwards anyway. Please use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen, not the chat function ideally, just the Q&A function. And we'll try and deal with those as we go along. So the topic for today, as I said, it is super topical. We're still dealing with the recruitment phase of our Employment 101 webinar sessions, and we're looking at recruitment post-COVID. Specific question, can you refuse to hire someone who hasn't had the COVID jab? So Sarah, what do you think about that?
Can you do it? Yes, of course. I mean, in employment law, you can do most things, but it doesn't mean that it's lawful, and it doesn't mean that it's risk-free. So I think that's really what you and I need to talk about today, Peter, is the kind of the risks attached to taking a course of action that means that you won't hire someone who's not had the COVID jab. So unsurprisingly, because this is a real interest area of mine, the first thing I always think about here is discrimination. Specifically indirect discrimination. And that, just so that people remember, is where you have a provision, criterion, or practice that on the face of it is neutral, but actually has a disparate impact on a particular group and also the particular individual who might be bringing the claim within that group. So the one that I always used to have thrown at me when I was at university was there's a requirement that all policemen are 6'2" or above. Well, actually, not all men are 6'2", but very few women are 6'2". So on the face of it, that looks like it's neutral, but actually, has a disparate impact on women. So that's a really kind of neat way to think about it. Obviously, we're not talking about policemen here or height. We're talking about vaccination. A mandatory approach to vaccination is likely to amount to a PCP, a provision, criterion, or practice. And what we're talking about here is, well, does that PCP put individuals with a protected characteristic at a particular disadvantage compared with others who don't share that characteristic? And there's quite a few characteristics that I think come into play here. So that could be age. Younger workers could be more cautious about a vaccine, given that they have a lower risk of hospitalisation if they get COVID, and also the higher risk of blood clots, particularly with some of the vaccines. Disability, so someone who's immunosuppressed, either because of a health condition or because they're taking drugs for a health condition that suppress their immune system. People with certain allergies who might be at greater risk. Also might be here in the disability space, a claim for discrimination arising from a disability if they don't get a job because they can't get vaccinated because of that disability. Sex discrimination, particularly in respect of pregnant women, because I've got a friend at the moment who's pregnant, and the advice for pregnant women seems to change on a daily basis. So, you know, it's nerve-wracking enough when you're pregnant, as I know myself, to then kind of have that additional layer of, well, is the vaccine going to harm my baby or not? I think that's a potential area. Race, there are, you know, it's been all over the press that there are certain groups, certain ethnic groups, certain cultural groups who are more nervous than others about having the vaccine. Is that mandatory requirement going to impact them more than others? And then finally, religion or belief. So I think Peter, I'm right in saying that there isn't any animal product in the vaccine. And I think religious groups have kind of come out, haven't they, and said, you know, we support the vaccine overall. However, fetal material was used in the development of the vaccine. And that might be an issue for certain groups. For example, there are some Christians who believe that life begins at conception. And so they may not be happy with having a vaccine that has had some element of fetal material involved in its development. So all of that stuff can apply even to someone who hasn't arrived yet. It doesn't have to be an employee. It can be someone who is applying for a job. It can be a worker. All of those rights apply as soon as they kind of make contact with the company, if you like. So you've got to be really, really careful to make sure that your PCP isn't going to indirectly impact those groups. And you need to think really carefully about whether you can objectively justify that. And where I think people might struggle with that is, I think there are other things that people can do. And I think we're going to come on and talk about that in a bit, aren't we, Peter, about kind of less draconian measures. The last thing I wanted to say, just because, again, it's something that comes up a lot, is the idea of anti-vax beliefs and whether they would qualify for religion or belief protection. And there's been quite a lot of news recently for employment lawyers around the religion or belief protection in a different context in relation to transgender people. But the received wisdom on this, and I would not like any of our clients or contacts to be a test case. However, the received wisdom on this seems to be that anti-vax beliefs probably wouldn't justify a refusal to be vaccinated. And the reason for that is that there are five kind of key criteria that was laid out in the key case on religion and belief, which is a few years old now. And the last one of those criteria was that the belief must be worthy of respect in a democratic society. This stuff, I think, is coming from social media. It's coming from conspiracy theory. And I think the general view is that that wouldn't be considered worthy of belief in a democratic society. However, it's not tested, so who knows? I mean, Peter, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole thing about the indirect discrimination arguments is that it can be objectively justified, but you're going to ultimately have to show that having a mandatory vaccination was a proportionate means of reaching that legitimate aim. I mean, I think just going on to the anti-vax stuff specifically, we've seen those other judgments where things like veganism is capable of being protected, you know, as a concept. I think there was a case to do with the belief in climate change as well.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not beyond the realms of possibility that an anti-vaxxer argument could succeed. But like you've said, I mean, a lot of the stuff that I've been reading about, when you look at those five Granger tests, it's not, for me, I looked at it and thought, well, it's not even necessarily the last one about, is it a belief that's worthy of respect in a democratic society? Because, you know, when you look at some of the other criteria as well, you know, it cannot be something that's an opinion or a viewpoint that's based on the present state of available information. And I suppose there's an argument that actually the science and the thinking behind all of this isn't sufficiently developed yet. So people might have ideas and opinions on how the vaccination may affect people, but the vaccination program, I mean, I suppose it's coming around to what, 10, 11 months of use now, if it started around December last year, but maybe some of those longer term proposed effects or effects that people are worrying about haven't actually manifested themselves yet. But like you said, we don't want any of our clients to be test cases on this stuff. But I think, for me, the risk of somebody being able to get home with an anti-vaxxer viewpoint being protected under the Equality Act as a belief, I think is quite low in terms of prospects. But yeah, we're all waiting for that one case to come through the tribunal and decide that issue, aren't we? Because I think it's inevitable that someone's going to try and run that argument at some point. Just jumping back to the indirect discrimination point, and in fact, the discrimination arising from disability, like I said, those concepts can be objectively justified, but you've got to show that if you're taking that point as an organisation, really mandatory vaccination of your prospective employees was that proportionate means of reaching a legitimate aim? That's the legal test for it. What do you think about those arguments, Sarah?
Well, I think, to be honest, I think you're probably going to struggle there a bit, because I think we've seen from workplaces that were operating before the COVID vaccine or when the vaccine program was in its infancy, that there are lots of other things that can be done to manage the risk. So from a health and safety perspective, for example. So it's quite clear, well, at least I hope it's quite clear, because I've had the vaccine and this was one of the reasons why I did it, that the vaccine reduces the chance of the individual getting COVID, right? So you might still get COVID, but you might not. And if you get it, it might be that the symptoms are milder. But actually, in terms of transmission, my understanding is that there's still, the jury's still out on whether it can reduce transmission or not. And Public Health England are sort of using words like, you know, it's less clear whether it reduces transmission, and it's less likely that vaccinated workers will pass on COVID-19 to others, but that's because the vaccine shortens the viral shedding period. If anyone on here knows what the viral shedding period is, then I'm going to bow to your greater knowledge, and I'm just going to put that out there. But effectively, the impact is we think that the COVID-19 vaccination has a positive impact on reducing transmission, but we don't really know. So if we don't know that, and we also don't know how long the vaccination protects people for yet, then actually, how can we be saying that just asking for vaccination is a substitute for all of the other workplace COVID secure measures that we've all got used to as we've gradually kind of found our way back into the workplace? Yeah. So, I mean, I think you need to do a really thorough risk assessment process, which I'm sure you've all done, because you will have had to do it if you're, you know, if you've got people, whether you've got people working at home or in the office. All of the health and safety stuff that is critical here means that you need to do a proper risk assessment process. And I think you could show through that risk assessment that having a vaccine is the most reasonably practicable way of mitigating all that risk of people getting COVID. And you could mandate the vaccine as a result. But actually, in reality, I don't think that really works outside of perhaps like a healthcare setting or an old people's home or something like that. So I don't know, what do you think? Do you agree, or am I being too weak?
No, I mean, I think it's my sort of personal view on it is I think that's kind of almost the mandating the vaccination, I think, is probably the last tool to use, really, you know, when you've exhausted some other options. And it's interesting that you mentioned healthcare settings, actually, because it's just reminded me that to mention that you all probably know that there's legislation in place that care homes, to be able to work in a care home, you must be vaccinated. And I forget the exact date that that's coming in. I think it's the first week of November that it's taking effect from. And I know that there will be care homes that are out there at the moment that are perhaps going through some kind of consultation process or looking at how to actually address the issue of some employees who may not be able to be vaccinated, and then subsequently what happens to their roles as well. But the bottom line is mandatory vaccination for care home workers is there. And actually the government has launched a consultation on the requirement to vaccinate frontline healthcare and social workers as well. So there's a consultation on that at the moment. So, you know, given that the government are canvassing opinion on it, it wouldn't be surprising if subsequently we see that mandated in those sectors also. So that's something to watch out for. In terms of, you know, just general other considerations, we've got the human rights angle to this as well. And I know kind of human rights arguments, they really kind of get mentioned really in our day-to-day employment work, but this is a new and developing area of law. So when we're talking about human rights issues, primarily we're looking at Article 8, which is the right to privacy. And the considerations here are, you know, are there less invasive ways to minimise the risk of transmission in the workplace than mandating people need to be vaccinated? And also Article 9 as well, right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion. And that kind of dovetails maybe on the religious side, religion slash belief side in terms of, well, what's actually in the vaccine? Does my religion permit me to be vaccinated either because of the content of the vaccine or the vaccination process itself? And what about, you know, my belief in terms of what the vaccination could actually do to me? So there are some arguments that could arise under those points. Something else which I think is a little bit more of an outside risk, but it's also worth mentioning, is if you're mandating that either new hires or existing employees need to be vaccinated, they go and get vaccinated in order to get a job with you or maintain employment with you as well, and they then suffer some kind of long-term ill health effect as a result, is there scope for a personal injury claim against the organisation as well? Again, it's not kind of in the flights of fancy that that could happen. It's probably a bit more of a remote risk, but it's something to be mindful of and go into your planning process if you're thinking about actually mandating vaccines for people.
That ties in quite nicely to something else that I've been thinking about a lot, which is negative publicity. And, you know, that's not a legal concept, but actually, you know, for all of the corporates that we work with, bad PR is, it's really important. There's potential for brand damage here, because, you know, the press are really interested in this. It's all over the press at the moment. Every time there's a development, the papers and, kind of television news, the online news, they're absolutely full of it. And I think, you know, you've got to, all of these risks that we're talking about, you've got to layer that with that risk of negative publicity as well, particularly if someone, you know, I mean, I can see the headlines in, I won't mention the newspaper, but one of the newspapers that I always use in my head when I'm thinking about negative publicity, and you can see the headlines now, you know, if someone mandates a vaccine and then someone gets really ill, it's not pretty, really. The other thing, just to go back and geek out slightly, I'm afraid, on data privacy, which is another area of interest of mine.
Area of interest.
It's not my favourite area of interest, actually, as you well know. It does constantly surprise me, Peter, given that in my previous in-house roles, if anyone mentioned data privacy, I would be off like a shot and at the other end of Canary Wharf or Uxbridge or wherever I happen to be. The fact that I do it so much now surprises me. But there we go. I've grown as a person. Data privacy, you've got to be conscious that health data is special category data. So if you're going to be managing that in terms of people's vaccine status, you've got to make sure that you do it in a legally compliant way. And I'm not going to go into all the detail of that, because, you know, we can talk to you about that offline if that's something you're thinking about. But you definitely need to kind of make sure it's super secure, that you're only taking exactly what you need, that you don't hold on to it for longer than you need to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, lots to think about here. The other thing, and I touched on this a little bit earlier when we were talking about discrimination, but we're not just talking about employees here, are we, Peter? It goes more widely than that. So what about if someone wants to use someone from an agency? Can they just say, I'm not going to use someone if they're not vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about agency workers is they still have the benefit of the discrimination protection that we've talked about. So they're still protected under the Equality Act, even though you as an organisation might not be that person's employer. Now, it's probably low risk in reality. And the reason for that is if you've got someone who hasn't worked for you before and can't work for you because you're not letting non-vaccinated people actually come and work for you at all, they're probably not going to make a claim, because I think the chances are the agency would just redeploy or deploy that person into another job where they're going to have an income. So there's probably not going to be any loss of earnings. Question mark, could that individual say that they've suffered injury to feelings as a result of them not being able to come and work for you? Probably not. But again, I mean, it's not in the flights of fancy that someone might go ahead and bring a claim against you to try and assert those rights. I think it also depends on the approach that the agency you're working with also takes. So are they being thoughtful about how they manage the deployment of staff, where they're sending those people, bearing in mind the particular needs that the agency workers may have themselves. Obviously, this is going to be relevant if you're an agency specialising in healthcare or social care and all of that stuff, because of the changes that are happening there. And actually, I just want to link, we've had a couple of questions. So thank you for those. I mean, Elaine's commented, with the difficulty of getting care staff, it will be interesting to see whether care homes do mandate the requirement despite the government review. So I think I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for care homes, my understanding is that's already been mandated. That's definitely happening in a couple of weeks' time. So no choice on that. The care home sector, I was reading last week, has around 100,000 vacancies. But separately to that, you know, it's going to be mandated for NHS workers and other general healthcare and social care frontline workers, because I think I also read separately the wider healthcare sector, not just the care home sector, in fact, separate to the care home sector, also has 100,000 vacancies. And of course, you've got to factor in for your own business planning purposes. If you're putting this barrier in of mandating vaccines, that's actually you're reducing the talent pool that's available to you. Now, of course, it might be entirely justified for your business for all the reasons we've talked about, you know, why it might be a good idea that you're doing this, but equally it will have an impact on who's actually able to come and work for you. The other question we've had from Mina, thank you for your question, is what about people who have allergies to vaccines or are people that medically cannot have the vaccine? What do you think about that? Sarah?
Well, I mean, that's where you get into your disability discrimination and your indirect disability discrimination in particular, because if someone's got an allergy, there is certainly, I mean, you cannot force someone who has an allergy to have a vaccine. And I guess there's a question over whether that allergy would amount to a disability, which would then entitle that person to protection from discrimination for kind of not being able to have the vaccine because of that allergy. I'm not aware that there's any case law on that as it stands, but I suspect there will be at some point, because it's simply the case that you cannot force someone who has an allergy to a vaccine to have that vaccine. That's not reasonable. And therefore, I think the tribunals are going to have to find some way of protecting that individual. Do you agree?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, completely. And, you know, I think, tribunals are generally very, very busy at the moment. I think they're prioritising COVID-related cases, but it's not going to be too long before we start getting some judicial authority on some of these points. I think one of the takeaways from today is this is an untested area, you know, linking in with that point about lack of case law. So that also means that it's not easy to actually try and interpret and deal with, you know, not least from an advisory perspective, but for those of you on the front line having to make decisions about this stuff as well on policy, it's also very difficult. If you do want to take this step though, then you really need a clear risk assessment. And that risk assessment particularly needs to talk to why other less draconian measures are not sufficient in the context of your particular business.
And Peter, that's actually perfect timing, because we've just had another question from Alison. Thank you, Alison. And I think that segues beautifully into what you've just said.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Alison says, what should we consider where one of our clients requests that our employee who's scheduled to be on their site for a day should be vaccinated? Would having a PCR or lateral flow be considered a reasonable alternative? And should we push the client to be more reasonable? I mean, that's it in a nutshell, isn't it? It's those more reasonable measures. And one of the things that we have talked about, you know, as a team, when we've been talking about this is, you know, and this is not so much in the context of recruiting people, it's in the context of, you know, current staff, but as a general policy position for your business, can you just have mandatory testing, for example? Because whilst mandatory testing isn't without its problems in terms of discrimination and that kind of thing, it's far, far less draconian and therefore a far lesser risk, I think. I think Alison, yeah, I think you should be saying, look, you know, this isn't a mandate for us. Can you show us your risk assessment that explains why that's the only appropriate measure? We're not prepared to mandate that for our employee, but we are prepared to ask them to do a PCR. Will that be sufficient? I still think that the number of businesses that are actually going to go for, so businesses that are not mandated by the government that are going to go voluntarily for mandating vaccination, I'm not sure we're going to see lots and lots and lots of those. So what do you think, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I know, you know, you and I talked briefly about using the COVID pass as a means of being able to screen employees, and I don't know whether our COVID pass is the same as the French one, for example. And we know with the French one, there's a means of being able to demonstrate that you've recently tested negative COVID if you're not vaccinated. So this is as an alternative to being able to show your vaccinated status. If you are not vaccinated, can you instead use the COVID pass to show that you've recently taken a test, a PCR test, for example, and you've tested negative? I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but maybe if that app develops, that could be a means of using it. And I mean, some of the other things that could be used is, you know, strongly encouraging vaccinations. And there's some Public Health England guidance about how to go about doing that. You could even incentivize your employees to be vaccinated as well. I know some firms are talking about some form of financial incentives just to try and encourage take up of the vaccination. But of course, that's not entirely risk-free because we've still got to be mindful of the PCPs, the provision criteria and practices that we're rolling out, and is there any exposure for us in respect of any discrimination claims. We're coming to the end of this session, because it is a bite-sized session. I just want to say that if you're not connected with us on LinkedIn, then by all means, please do look us up. We post a lot of content on there, but in particular, what I'll do after this session is I'll post up the links to the Public Health England guidance. I'll put the link up to the government consultation on mandatory vaccination in wider healthcare settings, if that's of interest to you. And I'll also put the link up to the ICO guidance as well for employers, because I think there's something in there for everybody, isn't there, Sarah?
Definitely, yeah. And I think the other thing for me, so Peter's going to give and I'm going to ask to receive. We'd love some feedback on how you're finding these sessions, what's working, what's not working, any topics that you might like us to cover. Our plan is to go right around the employee life cycle, looking at all of these key issues. So I hope we'll have the breadth to cover anything you might be interested in. So it's a resource that you can refer back to time and again. But look, by all means, drop us an email, contact us on LinkedIn, let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you.
And what have we got in 2 weeks' time? I think that's our next session, isn't it?
So it's another recruitment session. It's going to be Verity and Adrienne because we're mixing it up. So I won't be here to do my jazz hands. I shall have to ask Verity to do that for me. And I think we're going to be talking again in the recruitment space, but this time about how you kind of pull together a package to attract talent. So kind of benefits, bonus, how you should be thinking about all of that stuff with an employment law perspective.
Brilliant. Excellent. So tune in for that one. If you've registered for this session, you'll automatically be registered for that one. As a reminder, we're going to be hosting the recording of this session on our website very soon. We'll send an alert out in respect of that. Otherwise, just like to say, enjoy the rest of your week and we'll see you for the next one.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.